Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello, Rank Squad, and welcome to Ranks FC. It's your favourite transatlantic football podcast, and we're looking at the international scene today. My name's Jack Collins, and I'll be your host. And joining me all the way from San Diego is Mr. Dean Jones. How you doing, mate?
England. Here we go, mate. Here we go. Let's get the hype train going. I might be in San Diego, but I'm still English, just about. I'm not sure how long you have to be here to lose your identity, but a year in, I think I'm still qualifying as fully fledged Englishman.
Yeah, just about is probably the way I would put it.
It's weird though, mate. You do lose a little bit of you worry a little bit about losing your identity and being like, oh, is everyone still going to consider me English? Like, I've started saying trash. Like,
do you say line instead of queue now?
Yeah, I say line instead of queue. I do.
Do you call petrol gas?
I do.
Yeah, mate.
No one knows what you're talking about if you say the other thing. So I've just started to, hey, can I get an iced water? If I say, excuse me, could I get a water? They go, what? So I've had to say, can I get an iced water?
I don't think you need to put the accent on, but
I don't think I put on the accent quite that far, but you have to say ice water. Like, I don't know. Like, it's really weird, mate. It's really weird how little effort some people will put into listening to a different accent. People generally obviously love the English accent in America. And I'm not going to say it doesn't come without its privileges, because it does. And sometimes if I feel that someone isn't taking me seriously enough, I'll go proper Queen's English mode. And I tend to get taken more seriously and get some proper respect. But if you go to Starbucks, sometimes I just stick a really bad American accent on it. Gets you through the line quicker.
through the queue quicker. It's important to remember your bit. And talking of remembering your roots, if you thought that I wasn't going to start this podcast by talking about Troy Parrott, well, you had another thing coming. The national bird of Ireland, as one of our patrons, Brant, says, has been changed from the Northern Lapwing to the Parrot after this. 5 goals in 2 games, and Troy Parrott has sent Ireland to the World Cup playoffs. It has been an incredible couple of days to be an Ireland fan. You know, in the rugby, in the golf, we've had wins all around. But if someone had said to me that Ireland were going to win against Portugal and then against Hungary to find a back door into the World Cup playoffs. And not the World Cup, there's still work to do. There's still a whole mountain to climb when these playoffs come through, and the draw's on Thursday, so we'll find out our fate at that moment. But even to be still alive, considering where Ireland were going into this international break, has been really quite something. And Dean, it was one of the most remarkable things I've ever seen. Yeah, that Troy Parrott, who came from kind of nowhere, scored 10 goals in an Ireland shirt now. 5 of them come in the last 5 days. So, you know, we've gone from a player who was second fiddle to Evan Ferguson without being the starting guy, and, you know, looking at this international break and thinking, who's going to lead the line in Evan Ferguson's absence? It was a toss-up, right? It could have been Troy Parrott. It could have been Johnny Kenny, who's been starting for Celtic of late. It could have been Adam Eder. And instead, a few days later, Ireland has a full national hero on its hands. And, you know, part of some of the most incredible scenes that we could have ever, ever hoped for over this international break.
The only comparison I've really got from an England perspective is when Beckham scored that free kick at Old Trafford. Like, that's the moment that I'm comparing to your Irish moment. Because, like, the whole commentary, like, Beckham standing over the ball, England need to score the goal to qualify, and he bends it straight into the top corner, and it was just madness. And, like, I can remember exactly the stool I was sat on in the pub and jumping around with my mates. I remember we just had football training and, like, we'd run straight into the pub to watch the game. I remember it so clearly, and it's just one of those moments that kind of lived with you forever, and that's what that Parrott moment will do for you. I mean, whether it actually leads to anything, mate, still remains to be seen. I mean, there are 48 teams qualifying for this World Cup. So let's start the show by just addressing that if there's ever a World Cup you're going to qualify, it should probably be this one. I mean, you've already got just going to the World Cup already that you might not expect to typically make it. Qatar are going to be there. Iran will be there. Uzbekistan have made it, mate. I mean, this is motivation for Republic of Ireland. Now, obviously, it depends what region you're qualifying from, depending on how hard the pathway might be to get there. And, you know, the European competitiveness is probably a bit tougher than some of the other regions. But New Zealand are there, mate. So I'd like to believe that Republic of Ireland could get there and give them a good game.
Yeah, I mean, look, Gennaro Gattuso spoke about this, right? He was like, yes, obviously Europe gets the most spots, but it's still, you know, comparatively, it's 16 from, you know, a big, big pool of teams. He was like, whereas, you know, you look at South American qualification, for example, and look, this isn't necessarily me, you know, complaining about it, because I think that the World Cup is always richer for having a vast array of teams from across the world. His complaint was, he was like, you've got 65-odd% chance of qualifying from South America, because yeah, there's 10 teams, there's 6 automatic spots, and there's an extra one which takes you to a playoff.
Alive that have lost like 10 games or something.
Whereas he was like, you know, you lose 2 games in European qualification, you're done and dusted. And I take that point. I think the CONMEBOL qualification is one of the most incredible things on earth. It's just so much fun. And the chaos towards the bottom of that always tends to be, you know, an absolute heap of enjoyment. But it is a point that's, you know, that you look at in terms of percentages. I do think that we shouldn't overburden the World Cup by, you know, having more than half of it as a European test, because that's not what this is supposed to be about. And look, I'm sure that the Asian Federation will go, well, hang on, your 16 spots look pretty good for the amount of teams that we've got within the here and making a way. And look, I think that the CAF could point to the same in Africa. But it, you know, there is a frustration, and at least an argument around that from someone like Gennaro Gattuso, who's like, well, you know, we're Italy, we're not going to make it. I was like, well, stop being bad.
Well, exactly. And, I'm sorry, Gattuso, but you, the only person to blame at the moment is yourself. So I'm not feeling any pity upon you. If like you go to the World Cup at this in this state, you're getting absolutely battered every game anyway.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, there's different elements to all of it and different qualification bits, but it was really quite stunning. And Troy Parrott has etched his name into Irish football history. The first time we've seen someone this celebrated for a long, long time in that number 9 role.
Crazy. What a feeling it must be for him, like, to become an overnight sensation, but I guess it was 4 nights really. But yeah, to be heading back to his club now and getting back to life at Azad Alkmaar must be very, very weird. Very weird to just suddenly be like, it's like when, you know, people who are in huge bands talk about they've played the show of their life. Suddenly they're just sat back on the couch thinking like, oh, where's all my adulation gone? And he like, but then he did say he's watched the goal like 5,000 times from that Hungary game. So I think at least he's got the YouTube to carry him through until we get to a transfer window where he has Real Madrid and Barcelona and Liverpool and Man City and everybody else chasing him.
The Troy Parrott Ballon d'Or charge is on. Yeah. Is all I've got to say about it. Look, just on Parrott, because he's become a bit, as you say, not quite an overnight sensation, but he won't feel like that for him. You know, he left Tottenham. He had loan spells in the Championship. None of them really stuck. I remember a particular one at Millwall where, you know, people were looking at it and going, "This isn't the guy. This isn't, you know, he's not up to the task." And he took a relatively low money move to go to AZ Alkmaar. It wasn't a particularly high fee, and he's had to rebuild himself from the bottom up as, you know, someone who was once trumpeted as the kind of heir to Harry Kane. You know, he's had to kind of knock himself down a few pegs and work his way back. But in the last year and a half, he's been absolutely brilliant for AZ Alkmaar, right? Like he has really stepped into that breach. He has become the undisputed number 9 there. He's, you know, having a very good season. I think he's got 10 goals already for club. And so we're looking at a player who hasn't just come out of nowhere and is, you know, this isn't effectively Gio Reyna coming back and scoring for the USMNT, right? Who has barely played 100 minutes for his new club, Borussia Mönchengladbach, and barely played for his old club at the back end of last season and suddenly comes back onto the international stage and finds a moment. Troy Parrott has been working for this, and he's really kind of in a way that makes this feel good story probably an even better story. It's not one of those where you just go, oh, he's here and he's arrived. This is something he's been working really, really hard for a while. And it's lovely to see that pay off on such a stage as this.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So look, you've got your hero now, mate. You've got your golden balls. Let's see if he can take you that final step that you need. Look, I'd love you to be there. Like, Irish fans are going to make the World Cup a much better event. And you know, I absolutely want you to be. And now that you've got this chance, I really hope that you make it.
Fingers crossed that it's a favourable draw in these playoffs. Yes. So we shall see on Thursday how Ireland's task is going to be like. Right, we'll take a break there. When we come back, we're going to be talking about our main ranking. We'll be going through some of the favourites for the World Cup. Make sure you stick with us here on Ranks FC. Welcome back to Ranks FC, where we're starting to look at the favourites for next summer's World Cup. It feels like, Dean, this is a good part and a good time to do this. We are now, you know, 7-8 months away from the World Cup beginning. Most of the qualification cycles are ending. Most of the favourites will have secured their spots a long time ago, or at least be on the very cusp of doing so. And we can discuss them at length. There are four teams I had sort of in the pack here, but I wanted to start with an honourable mention, because it feels wrong to talk about World Cup favourites and not talk about Brazil. Okay. It just doesn't feel like something that we're, you know, that we should be doing. But, you know, I don't know if I'm comfortable saying that Brazil are the fifth favourite to go and win this World Cup right now. I don't think that would be fair. I don't think that would be right. So we're going to just talk about them in a slightly different light before we come on to our 4-1. Okay. But, you know, Brazil were the country most synonymous with the World Cup, right? They lifted their fifth trophy in 2002. They were the team that the Seleção, the team you associate with World Cups. When you think of the glory of this tournament and the Jules Rimet trophy, it's not hard to imagine it in the hands of someone wearing that canary yellow shirt. But they haven't reached any of the five finals since that 2002 victory. The only time they've reached a semi-final in that time, they don't want to talk about it because of what happened at home against Germany. And so something had to change in this cycle. Now, you're looking at this and it's still a team which maybe isn't quite as talented as some of the crops of the past, but there are still a fair amount of very, very good players who play for Brazil. And they went and made the bold move of bringing in Carlo Ancelotti as the manager. So bringing in someone who has no real association with it, who, you know, doesn't have the same, you know, language as the country, and who is coming in here as very much kind of an outsider, but also a godfather of world football. Now, he'll have a relationship with many of these players already. It's not necessarily a question, and no one is challenging Carlo Ancelotti's credentials. But the truth is that Brazil have had to try and do something different, right? They've had to try and reach for something else to try and lead them to the glory that they've been looking for in all of these years. So Carlo took over in May. He came in at a pretty low point for Brazil. They just lost 4-1 to Argentina in qualification, which wasn't necessarily going to affect their chances of making the World Cup, but definitely had everyone at an all-time low. And Dorival Jr. had to go at that point. And they ended up, if you look at the CONMEBOL table as it finished, they ended up fifth. Now, some of that is a little bit false in terms of, you know, you get to the final games, they've already qualified, teams are still absolutely scrapping to try and make it in those final days. He's able to experiment a little bit more, and there's not that much time for Ancelotti, so he's trying to see different players in different positions and work around. So I think you could excuse some of the losses towards the end of the qualification campaign, and fifth is probably a little bit of a misnomer, although it's not that much of one. They probably deserve to come fourth, maybe third at a real push in CONMEBOL qualifying. They've, you know, lost 6 of those 18 games. It's been quite interesting keeping an eye on Brazil over the last few international breaks, because, you know, they've had a number of different games, and some of these games have been really impressive and some of them have been far less impressive. They lost 3-2 to Japan in the last international break, and also they beat South Korea 5-0 in probably the best performance we've seen for them under Carlo Ancelotti. And it was like, whoa, okay, are Brazil back? There's a real flavour about what they're doing. There's some really interesting bits and bobs going on with them that we can kind of take something off. Now, they won 2-0 against Senegal, and they'll be playing against Tunisia as well before you listen to this podcast. But I still find it incredibly hard to get a handle on exactly what this team is, one, going to look like, and two, what their ceiling is next summer. Because whilst I think you can look at it and say, yeah, okay, there are bits and bobs that I don't hugely like, you saw the goal from Estevao, who has stepped in on this stage. We spoke about him, obviously, in last week's podcast. He stepped onto the international stage and gone, right, I know what to do here, picked up where he's left off. You're looking at the midfield and thinking Casemiro, Bruno Guimarães, Lucas Paqueta. There's a lot of very, very talented footballers in these areas. They have an incredible array of attacking stars still in Rodrigo and Vinny Jr. and Rafinha and Estevao now and Mateus Cunha, who, okay, was playing for Wolves at the time that the last, you know, his last call-ups came, and now he's playing for Manchester United and taking on a big role and wearing the 10 shirt at Old Trafford. It does feel to me like they're in a bit of a strange place in that the expectations sometimes subvert the reality.
Yeah, look, I can tell you what they're going to look like. They're going to wear yellow shirts with green trim, and that strikes fear into everyone as soon as they walk onto a football pitch. Like, the leaks of their World Cup kit are, like, inspired by the iconic 1970 kit, and the leaked pics look pretty cool. So it's one of those jerseys that, like, you're just excited to see. Like, when you watch the World Cup, you just make sure you watch Brazil. Like, Brazil just means World Cup to me. Like, it's just football. It's just, you think of, like, even though, like, I don't know if there's anyone listening to this podcast that was watching Pele in his pomp, but, like, all of us have seen the videos of Pele and we know what those images are. And then, depends when you grew up, who you liked watching. Like, for me, you know, the first Ronaldo, the number nine Ronaldo, Ronaldinho, all that kind of stuff. And it's just, like, it's magical.
Do you want to feel old?
I always feel old, but go on.
20 years ago today was the day, as we're recording this, was the day that Ronaldinho got the standing ovation at the Bernabeu.
Oh, was it? Wasn't it that one? But but that is quite funny. Yeah, and I did meet Ronaldinho, and I'll say, yeah, don't always meet your heroes. It wasn't the best experience of my life. But look, it's special to see Brazil. And what's interesting about Ancelotti is we watched Real Madrid, right? And it was all about vibes. Like, you didn't know what their plan was. They didn't know what their plan was. They didn't have a real structure. If you look at a structure of a Brazil team for the World Cup, it might be a 4-2-4, but it's going to be loose. It's going to be go and do your thing. He wants as many of those exciting players as he can on the pitch. And I hope Estevao, like, continues to flourish, because that's the sort of player that ends up lighting up a tournament like this. So I'm excited by it a lot. I don't have massive expectations for them to win the tournament, but as soon as you see a tournament and Brazil are playing in it, oh God, it's just great. It's just great. It's just one of the most iconic things about any World Cup.
Yeah, 100%. We're excited to see what they look like. But I think that trying to predict exactly how they're going to play or what it's going to look like by the time that they get there is a bit of a fool's errand right now. But it felt wrong to not include them in this discussion.
Yeah, the Netherlands won't be happier than being at five, because I think that the Netherlands would feel that you know, if they make their mark at a World Cup, then they can go and do it. I mean, we'll have to wait. I don't believe that either. But I've seen a lot of rankings for early rankings of who would win the World Cup. And yeah, the Netherlands are a lot of people's pick, actually.
Beautiful bridesmaids dressed in orange, as the book says, right? Yeah. Like, always the bridesmaid, never the bride.
They qualified yet, have they, as we record this? Like, are they mathematically there even?
Yeah, they did. They qualified on Sunday.
On Sunday, they make
it. It was a late, well, it went to the last game, but they are there. They will be there, the boys in orange, who are also a delight. And look,
exactly,
Germany will be a little bit annoyed not to be on this list either, but I'm yet to completely trust where Julian Nagelsmann's Germany are.
They look all right, though, mate. They do look all right. But yeah, Nagelsmann definitely doesn't have the trust of his nation either at the moment, I think it's fair to say.
I think that's probably fair. Shall we come on then to our list? And I hand over to you for number four.
Yeah, let's crack on with the way that we are going to move through these. And at number four, we're going to go with England. Because they're going to be, look, if we're talking about the final four, they should be there. It's really, really hard to gauge exactly where they end up. But what we know is that they've got great form in major tournaments coming into this one. Semi-finalists, runners-up, quarter-finalists, runners-up. Like, England have created a sense of expectation through the Gareth Southgate years that's exceeded anything we'd ever had before, really. We were always hopeful, but never expectant that we could actually get even to finals. And now we're getting to those finals and we're just falling short. So there's still some work to be done, but at least there's been a lot of progress made. Now, obviously, a lot of people got sick of Gareth Southgate in terms of him being considered dull, boring, dour. And the Southgate era ended up kind of petering out. But for a while there, you know, Southgate, you're the one, you know, we were buzzing for what Gareth Southgate gave us. And Tuchel has to try to recreate that. He seems a lot more stern than Gareth Southgate. He seems a lot more combative within his own camp than Gareth Southgate ever was. And we will have to wait to see now whether that's a trait that can actually bring the best out of this group of players. I've got to admit, it seems a little bit risky. England are a great team, right? You look on paper, you look at the team, and they go like for like with anyone that you're going to get in the last four. So they'll get to the quarterfinal stage without problem here, and then we'll have to see who they come up against. Harry Kane, people keep saying, is in the form of his life. That's got to be a good thing. He was always good for England anyway. If he's in the form of his life, should be even better. They've gone through qualifying without conceding a goal. Great. So everything's kind of adding up. The real strange thing about England is that under Tuchel, he started to spark conflict within his own squad, and some of the media are now jumping on the back of it, and I just don't like this at all. Like, Jude Bellingham is becoming the, I don't want to say figure of hate, but it does feel like that from some people that are...
Lightning rod for criticism. There you go.
It's driving me mad, mate. It's driving me mad. There was an article yesterday, why England would be better off without Bellingham. Shut up. There's no world in which England could be better off without one of the best players we've ever produced. Like, what are you talking about? It's driving me mad. Bellingham is an unbelievable athlete. He is an incredible sportsman that's got to the top of his game so quickly. We talked about this on Patreon. Like, Bellingham breaking through when he did at Birmingham City, like making the mark that he did at that club, and then going on to Borussia Dortmund, going and doing it in another country, quickly establishing himself, smashing it over there, and then getting a move to Real Madrid. Like, it's been an incredible rise, and he's proving himself at every single level. And suddenly, Thomas Tuchel leaves him out of a squad. There's like, on the back of that, some doubts about whether he makes the team. He then goes back into the team last weekend, puts in a man of the match winning performance, shows a bit of frustration when his number goes up to be substituted, still shakes the manager's hand as he walks off. And all the headlines are about him throwing tantrums and his demeanor and all this stuff. It's like, hang on, do we want our best player to be happy he's being subbed? No. I don't want that. I want him to be spiky. I want him to have an ego. If he's going to play for the level of club that he has by the age of 22, if he's going to play for Real Madrid, if he's going to go and win the World Cup, he's got to believe that he should be on the pitch for every minute. And like, look, maybe he's substituted because he doesn't want him to be suspended, whatever it is. And like, that's within Tuchel's reasoning, right? That's fine. But Bellingham can be annoyed if Bellingham wants to be annoyed. Obviously, Tuchel's also trying to create this rivalry between him and Morgan Rogers. And the reason he's doing this is because England have, so far, in reaching the World Cup, had no outside competition to actually get to this point. Like, the team has breezed through qualification and they've had no problems. So what Tuchel's done is, within his own team, he's creating rivalries and conflict to give the players, the individuals, something to overcome to earn their place within the team. Which is very interesting, and we'll see whether it's a management tactic that pays off. Tuchel's literal job is to lead England through this tournament, win it, and then leave. Get out of there, right? That's his job. And because of that, he can take a more no-nonsense approach than Gareth Southgate ever did, right? Southgate was very much arm around you, I'll give you a cuddle if you need it, I'll tuck you in bed at night, whatever you need, I'll do it. Because I just want to, I love all of you and I want you to feel that. Now, Tuchel actually came away from this training camp saying he felt quite emotional saying goodbye to the players because he's not going to see them until March. And I was like, okay, the guy cares. And like, obviously, like, Southgate was iconic in terms of English football. Like, he was played a lot of games within the Premier League. He obviously missed the penalties and stuff, and he's had a good term as England manager, whatever. But he's pure English. With Tuchel, we've got a German in charge, right? One of our biggest rivals in international football. We've got one of their guys in charge of our team. And we've got to believe in him. It's a brave thing for the FA to do, because if he really messes this up, then people can turn on him in a way that they might not turn on others. But people do generally want Tuchel to be the guy. And Chelsea fans particularly were won over by Tuchel, obviously. And they make up a lot of the England support. So they are saying, let's back this guy. I just really hope his selection choices don't cause rifts and friction that stop us from winning this thing, because we're so close. Losing to Italy on penalties obviously still haunts me. To lose to Spain in the final that we got to, fair enough. We were a bit short of Spain that day, and I have no complaints about not winning that trophy.
They were the best team.
But we got to the final and we came close. We gave them a decent game. But we are right on the cusp of our greatest achievement ever. Winning this World Cup is better than winning it in 1966. The level of football is higher. We're not on home soil. This is the greatest achievement anyone would ever have as an England manager, as an England team. But beyond the semi-finals, I just don't know. Do we have the togetherness? Do we have the mindset to get the job done? We'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that Tuchel has done a few things that have been really bold, right? Like coming in and basically be like, yep, Elliot Anderson's my guy. He's the guy that I think is going to unlock everything else.
I like that.
Coming in and basically saying that, you know, Bellingham, Foden, and Kane can't all play in the same team because there's not, you know, not enough width between the three of them. Probably fair, you know, in terms of actually bouncing off. And look, you've got to make some bold calls, right? Like there have been, you look back through all the teams and look back at some of the selections, etc. Then you look at the teams that have gone and won World Cups, they've come from bold calls, but they've also come from players having moments, you know, off the bench, and players who come on being able to influence games and change them late on. And I think that, you know, in terms of some of the bits around you, Bellingham in particular, yeah, okay, there's been a bit too much noise, right? Like from where I'm standing. And I don't think that Tuchel's helping particularly in some of the comments he comes out with. But equally, I think that, you know, there is always that element of trying to find a storyline in everything and anything. But what he has done is given himself options in a variety of areas, right? Like, and I think that having players who are chomping at the bit to come on and change games, look, let's take Morgan Rodgers for an example here, right? Like, I don't think that Morgan Rodgers is going to be England's starting 10 at the World Cup, right? Like, I think that that job will go to Jude Bellingham. But if England needs someone to make something happen, well, they've seen that Morgan Rodgers has that. He's become accustomed to this squad. He's been able to change games. He's been able to be the guy for England in certain games to step up. There is no way that you would have thrown him into the fray in the World Cup next summer if he hadn't had those reps and that moment and the ability to come on and make his own name within the international setup in these qualifiers, where England, it should be noted, have won every single game and haven't conceded a goal, which is a record in qualification. No one else has done that. Now, even to achieve that and be on that kind of level footing is something pretty remarkable within itself. So I think that actually in a period where England have cruised through, and look, that's become par for the course now, but it wasn't always the case. You know, you have to look at that and say, okay, Tuchel's done all he can in terms of the qualification cycle, but also on top of that, he's come in there and he's blooded players and he's given opportunities to people who might be needed when the World Cup comes around. Because look, even if Jude Bellingham is going to be England's starting 10, what happens if 2 weeks before the World Cup he pulls up with an injury, right? And there's no one else to step into that role? Well, now Tuchel knows he has a guy in Morgan Rodgers that he has relied on during this qualification cycle where, yeah, is Jude Bellingham a better player than Morgan Rodgers? Of course he is. But in terms of having someone that you know and knows the team that's able to step in there ready-made and give yourself options in a variety of different places, I think that's all you can ask for from an international manager.
Yeah. I don't mind there being competition for places at all. I just don't want it to turn into conflict. I think that that's the fear I've got at this stage. And I hope that it's all hunky-dory behind the scenes. And I guess we'll find out more about that over the coming months. I hope that March doesn't turn into a time when we are reading about more problems, because as I say, I really haven't liked some of the articles I've been reading on the back of this international break. And I think part of the when you do kind of ease through qualification, it brings about problems because people don't know what to write about. It's like, oh, yeah. they won again. Oh, they haven't conceded a goal. What should we talk? Oh, look, Bellingham doesn't want to be substituted. Of course he doesn't want to be substituted. What footballer wants to be substituted? Drives me mad, mate. But yeah, look, this is part and parcel of international football, part and parcel of English football. Let's hope they can overcome it all.
Yeah, yeah, there you go. Right, let's go to number three, which is where I have the defending champions, Argentina. They obviously beat France on penalties in the final in Qatar back in 2022. And if you watch them at all during qualification, we talk about strolls. Well, this was pretty much a stroll in the same way. They finished 9 points above Ecuador, who finished in second. Ecuador were deducted 3 points, so it's worth pointing out. But still, it was a walk in the park in many ways for La Scaloneta, who have become accustomed to winning under Lionel Scaloni. And it has been such a turnaround for this team. You know, we were only 7-8 years ago, we were talking about the fact that Lionel Messi might never pull on the Albiceleste shirt again. And then suddenly his return sparks this incredible period where they win 2 Copa Americas and they finally lift that World Cup again. And the little man gets his moment in the sun. He gets that, the one that had eluded him, the thing that was held against him by, so you know, those in his homeland who always said he's good, but he's no Diego. Well, suddenly he has the honour to go alongside the great number 10. And they sit there now together in the pantheon. And look, he actually hasn't committed to playing in the World Cup yet. But I would be absolutely stunned if he is not playing in his adopted homeland in this one. So I feel like we're going to get Lionel Messi at the World Cup and everything will be richer for that fact. He was rested recently, which I thought was interesting because Scaloni wanted to see how Lautaro and Julian Alvarez played together in the front two, which went pretty well. But you can imagine it would have done because it's Lautaro and Julian Alvarez, right? They're two absolutely unbelievable players. I suppose you can talk about it for a variety of different ways, right? But the reason that Argentina remain amongst the favourites from my perspective is, yeah, this might not be a squad that competes on the same kind of level with a Spain or France or even an England. But I just feel like anyone who comes up against this Argentina side are going to be like, oh no, we're in big trouble. They have made a habit of winning consistently, winning tournaments, lifting silverware. And in the spine of this team, you think about it and you're thinking, right, Emi Martinez, who, yeah, okay, might not be quite as brilliant as he was a couple of years ago, but still remains one of the best goalkeepers in the world. Christian Romero, who I kind of maintain for me, remains one of the best centre-halves on the planet. You've got Messi in there, you've got Julian Alvarez, you've got Lautaro. In the midfield, you have Enzo Fernandez, you have Alexis McAllister. Don't know quite what it's going to look like for Rodrigo De Paul, but the options that they have in there and the players that have stepped up into this Argentina side are, you know, of such requisite quality that it almost doesn't matter. You know, if you can get this Argentina side to a position where they need to win, more often than not, in recent years, they have won. And for me, that's the reason that you put them above England at this point, because whilst I would say that the English first team and squad in general probably trumps it a little bit in terms of what we're looking at from this Argentina team, the flip side of that is that Argentina have been there, done that, and have the muscle memory now. And I just have that overwhelming feeling that, you know, you come up against them in a last 16 game, in a quarterfinal, they will leave absolutely every nerve and sinew on the pitch and they will win in whatever way is necessary. We've seen them win tournaments in different manners, you know, in the Copa Americas, whether it was scrappy, whether it was glorious, whether it was fighting back from being behind in the World Cup, having to deal with the fact that they had the lead and it looked like it was all done and dusted and then they were pulled back by France and ended up going all the way, you know, to that penalty shootout where they ended up triumphing. I just feel like they're an incredibly difficult team to get the better of. And that, for me, I think is the reason why it would be ludicrous to leave them out of a ranking like this.
Yeah, mate, like I've looked at other rankings. Just coming on this, I just wanted to see where people pitted other teams. And Argentina, a lot of people are going to pit them at number one. They're like, they're the team you've got to beat. Like, they're defending their crown. They've got Messi still. Like, we expect anyway that Messi's going to be there. And they are going to be the team to beat. And as you say, like, they will do whatever it takes to win. And, like, you know, part of the reason that England and Argentina have their rivalry is because, like, we're like, well, they cheat. We don't like them. They cheat. And they've knocked us out in some big moments and they've got the edge. It's like, because they'll do whatever it takes. And, you know, like, I'm not saying we're going to get a hand of God moment anymore. I think VAR might have a thing or two to say about that. But they'll do whatever it takes to get under your skin. They'll rattle you. But they'll also, at times, completely outplay you. So they've got many strings to their bow beyond just Messi. But obviously, having him would be a very helpful one. He's just had, I was going to say, a remarkable season in MLS. He's had some remarkable games in MLS this season.
He has had a remarkable season. He's had a remarkable playoff run and a very, very good end to the season, but he's been pretty special for the majority of it.
Yeah, I think I'm just tainted because I'm a San Diego FC fan who believes that Anders Dreyer is the true MVP of MLS. But that's a story for another day. Messi's had a great season. Like, Inter Miami shouldn't really win MLS, I don't think, when you assess the team. But they might well win MLS because of Messi. And Argentina obviously is a step up from that. And Messi himself has said, look, I'll see where I am. I'll go into pre-season with Inter Miami and then we'll see how I'm playing, how I'm feeling, and whether I'm going to be at the World Cup. Like, Messi's going to the World Cup.
The fact that he's just signed a contract extension, I think, should put paid to much chat, if I'm honest.
Yeah, if Messi does not go to this World Cup wearing the number 10 shirt, I'm not watching it. Right? We'll be robbed. Like, whatever rivalries exist between England and Argentina, I'm not watching a World Cup when it's supposed to be Messi's last one. This is part of what it's all about. So, Argentina have got a very good team still, and they've now got that defiance about them because they got something to actually protect.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just a question of, can you go and beat them? And the answer for so long has been no, not really. No one can. So it makes them, you know, right up amongst it in terms of the favourites. Let's move on to number two, shall we, Dean?
Yeah, let's talk about France, who equally are extremely difficult to stop. Winners and then runners up in the last two World Cups. Narrowly beaten by Spain in the Euros in the semi-finals. Came close in the Nations League as well. Didn't manage to get into the final of that, but still had a good run. They are a team that would become only the third team ever to reach three consecutive World Cup finals. West Germany have done it. Brazil have done it. And France are now going to try to get into the final for the third time in a row. In order to do that, I think they need to work out exactly how to unlock Prime Mbappe, because this is a bit more complicated than you would believe. Now, there's no doubt that Mbappe is going to score goals at the World Cup. I'm not doubting that. But the pieces around him must fit and maximize his strengths. And I don't think they've nailed that yet. They've got almost too many options in attack to know exactly what is their best way to go. Now, I've watched their last two qualifiers over the course of this campaign. Mbappe only played in the first one. What was really interesting when France played against Ukraine, Mbappe was the striker. Ukraine's centre-backs didn't have anybody to mark. It was really confusing for them, I think, because they spent the whole game, most of the game, with nobody up against them. And Mbappe was just like drifting around. And this is one of the things that's going to be really interesting, because they've got two different ways they can play. So they could play in this way where they're just going to keep the ball in front of you and just keep it there, keep it there, keep it there, and then eventually get in behind. Or if that's not working, then they'll take a more direct and traditional route and go for like, we're like, right, it's not working. Get Mateta on. We'll go direct. And that's kind of a bit more what they did in their second game in this international break when Mateta did start and Mbappe didn't play. Mateta ended up scoring. Now, it was a strange one. Like, they beat Ukraine 4-0, but for a long time, like, look, the Ukraine goalkeeper had a great game, but there was, they found it difficult to unlock the back door. And they play a lot of football, as I say, in front of the defence. But they've just got so many options to work with in that attacking line. And that's one of the things that France are going to have to decide as they now get to the World Cup finals, is what are going to be their best combinations, because that's going to be key. Now, in the early stages of the World Cup, the good thing for the top nations is that they can mess around a little bit. Like, they can play with the teams and they can toy with the other teams, because it should be that at least the first couple of games are reasonably easy for the top sides. But for that first match, you had Mbappe supposedly as the number nine, but didn't really play as a traditional nine. And then surrounded by Michael Olise, Rayan Cherki and Bradley Barcola. Mate, that is confusing to stop, because their rotations and their movements are so, oh my God, it was like baffling where they were all ending up. The skills that they were all pulling off, the wavelength they were playing on at sometimes was just like, it didn't always work. Don't get me wrong. It wasn't always like perfect, as I say, but then the second game,
but then that's not France's first choice front line.
And then in the second game though, they go with Hugo Ekitike, Christopher Nkunku, Magnus Akliouge, and Jean-Philippe Mateta. And you're like, okay, so they've gone with a completely different four. They're playing a bit more directly. They're going up against the back line in a different way, in a more physical way than they did in the first game. And still, we haven't really seen the combinations of what is their best attack. So that is painful for everybody else, because that is one of the best problems I can ever think of having in international football, right?
Yeah.
And I'll get you involved in 1 second, but to just go into the other things, and by the way, I like Olivier Giroud, like he's always been selfless in France's attack, and that's been a great asset, and that's something they've got to figure out what they do as the backup round. They've got options, don't get me wrong, but Giroud was always a good option to have around that. Now, in defence, I just assume it's going to be Koundé, Saliba, Upamecano, Dean, right? Or maybe one and change from that, right?
Yeah, maybe Théo.
Maybe Théo. So then they did play that lineup, and then in the last game, Konaté was actually captain. He played at centre-back. Théo Hernández did play. The other Hernandez played at centre back, and
Luca
Mal Augusto played at right back. So again, like, that's not bad. And the only concern I've seen really spoken about is that they haven't quite got the experience of other years, because you've lost some of the players like Hugo Lloris, like Varane, like Giroud, Griezmann. Like, there's a level of, experience that's just not quite there anymore. And look, in this last camp, they were without Ousmane Dembele, they were without Tchouaméni, they were without Marcus Thuram, they were without Rabiot. Like, there was people missing, right? But against Ukraine, the team had a combined cap count of 397. When they played Argentina in the last World Cup final, they had a combined cap count of 664.
Yeah.
That's a significant drop-off in terms of experience. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing, because the youthfulness, the next gen of Olise and Cherki and Ekitike and Akliouge is unbelievable. But I don't know how that makes you fare in those big moments in the semi-final and a final. So that's what I'm slightly unsure of with France, and how they kind of bridge that gap to see whether they can get over the line.
It's funny that, because I was trying to work out what I kind of took as the, okay, they're at what point in your cap numbers are you then a serious and experienced international? That's the question. And I kind of, my mark was probably about 30. You made 30 caps for your national team.
Okay.
You're probably into it that you feel pretty comfortable when you're going there, right? And I was looking at the cap numbers from, you know, the squad. Luka Dean, 55. Upamecano, 35. Koundé, 46. Saliba, 31. Luka Hernandez, 40. Teo Hernandez, 41. And then Konaté, who's the least capped of those, you know, with 26. So not miles off either. Obviously, N'Golo Kante has a lot of caps. He's got 65. But then you look at, you know, the players like Kylian Mbappe, 94 caps already. Kingsley Coman, 61 caps. Marcus Thuram, 31. Ousmane Dembele, 57. Like, even Kolo Muani's got 31 reps for the France national team.
I didn't even mention him there, did I? I didn't even mention Kolo Muani.
Camavinga, 28. Tchouameni, 43. Rabiot, 56. Like, I was starting to look at it and think, okay, this is a squad which still has some young players who are incredibly exciting, as you mentioned there. The likes of Akliouche, who I think is just sublime. The likes of Ryan Cherki, Desiré Doué, who was the man of the match in the Champions League final. You know, Ousmane Dembele, you know, Ballon d'Or winner, coming back in. I'm quite impressed with how many reps some of the younger players, or at least the kind of players who are like 25, 26, have already got for this France team. They've been very good at integrating, you know, the generations as they've come through, rather than waiting for a generation to almost expire, if you will, and like then be like, right, we just start again. What I have noticed is that it does feel like they've got a fair amount of experience in playing together already, and that's got to be a good thing from a France perspective.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like, the names that you reel off for France are just insane. And it's funny, like I say, when I look at the England squad and I look at our names on paper, I'm like, this seems unbeatable. But then I look at the other teams, I'm like, oh, so do they. So do they. So do they. And France definitely comes under that banner. And yeah, it's remarkable. Some of the players that you suddenly discover are French. You're like, oh, Ryan Cherki can't be French. Oh, come on.
The most French man of all time.
No, I know. But you know what I mean? Like, suddenly you see him getting into the team regularly. You're like, oh, man, this is annoying.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. And the versatility of some of those players as well. They are a force to be reckoned with. They can hurt you in so many ways. As Melissa Reddy said to me today when we were on the radio together, she was like, I just feel like they can hurt you in so many different methods. And I was like, yeah, it's a really fair point. Talking of brilliant squads, takes us on to number one, which is where I have Spain. Early bookmakers' favourites to go and win this whole thing, and seems pretty reasonable for them to have done so. They were the deserved winners of Euro 2024, as we alluded to earlier in the podcast, with that win over England. And they have such an incredible squad. Now, they lost the Nations League final on penalties to Portugal, but obviously that was a draw in real time. They lost it on penalties, so like officially by international statistics it counts as a draw. I'm sure that they weren't counting it as a draw in Spain. They were pretty angry about the entire thing. But the last time they lost a competitive game just like straight was against Scotland in March 2023. That was the last time that Spain lost a game. Now, we are recording this ahead of their game against Turkey, so things might have changed by the time you're listening to it, but I'd be very surprised. Turkey also need to beat Spain 7-0 if they are going to stop them qualifying for the World Cup in Spain. So I'm going to go on and assume that the team I have top of this list, who haven't actually officially qualified yet, are going to be there when it comes to next summer. Of course they will. But you look at this squad, Dean, and the midfield is terrifying for everyone else. So they haven't called up for this camp Pedri, Rodri, Gavi, which is a midfield that everyone would be absolutely terrified to play against. In their stead, you have Martin Zubimendi. You have Mikel Merino, the manager's dream. There's Fabian Ruiz, Pablo Barrios, Alex Baena, Pablo Fornals, and Alex Garcia, who remains one of my favourite players on the planet. And I just look at that and think, how do you get the ball off this Spain team? The last two games they've played ahead of this Turkey game, they've had 75% possession in those games. They are just incredible at keeping the ball. And look, we've seen iterations of Spain, I think particularly the Luis Enrique version of Spain, where everything didn't work out. They were beautifully positioned. They kept the ball really well, but they didn't know how to get in behind teams and make things happen. That has very much changed over the course of Luis de la Fuente's tenure. This is a Spain team that know how to be direct and get into the box when they need to. In Lamine Yamal and Nico Williams, they have two wingers who absolutely terrify the lights out of almost every single person on the planet who's not a Spain fan. They have a variety of ways they can hurt you through the middle. There have been some really interesting developments in who's going to be playing up front. It's been Mikel Oyarzabal for a little while, playing as a kind of I think a false nine is a misnomer. He's playing as a nine, but as someone who drifts off and picks up different elements. But Samuel Agahawa has kind of come through now at Porto, 21 years old, and is really starting to make his mark. They can play Ferran Torres through the middle there. They want to change it up and go direct. Yeah, Borja Iglesias can come into the mix as well. And look, I wonder if Gonzalo Garcia has a good back half of the season, if he might be in that conversation in the same way. You know, they can play Dani Olmo in the midfield if they want. They can play Fermin in the midfield if they want. They can change this up in so many different ways. And it feels like with Spain, and I think that whilst we can talk about France's depth and the quality they have, obviously, if you play someone like a JP Mateta instead of a Kylian Mbappe, you have to kind of change the system. And that can be a major strength. The thing that I look at with Spain is when one player drops out, someone just steps up and goes, yeah, no worries, I could play that role perfectly. And that, for me, I think is the terrifying thing about them. It's not that Spain have just a group of brilliant players. It's that they have a system and a structure that they fit into really nicely. And everyone is so well drilled in it that it's almost irrelevant. When Rodri, who was the Ballon d'Or winner, you know, last season, who was the best holding midfielder in the world, steps out of it and Zubimendi just walks in and goes, yep, no stress, got it, got you covered. And that for me is why Spain are the favourites to go and win this entire thing. They've just been a delight to watch over the last couple of years under Luis de la Fuente. And his rise through the youth ranks and into, you know, the top of the game and the very top of the international game has been truly quite remarkable. So you look at it, you look at that Euro 2024 run, they beat Germany, they beat France, they beat England in the quarters and semis and final. You know, they've had an incredible run of games. They, as you said, with France, they had a great run of the Nations League. They got to the final and lost on penalties to Portugal. They are on the longest unbeaten run in their history, 29 competitive games without defeat. It's just incredible that Pedri missed like most of the Euro 2024 knockout stage, and it just like they sort of shrugged and went, yeah, all right, no stress, we got it. Like that is depth that people can only dream of. Pedri, best midfielder in the world, and they were like, yeah, all right, no worries, no stress. Rodri out for the second half of the final, no stress. They're terrifying, Dean.
Yeah, they are. And what's weird about it is how they went out so meekly in the last World Cup in 2022. Let's just cast our minds back. Spain lost to Morocco on penalties. And at the time, there's a quote for, I saw, I quickly looked this up a second ago to see what people were saying at the time. Spanish football expert Guillem Balaguer says Spain are miles away from competing with the top nations. They won the Euros 2 years later. Like, that's how quickly, that's how this team adapts to systems and that players come through and learn their roles and overcome mental hurdles. They just are not, they don't get stuck in the past. They just have a psychological edge over so many other nations when it just comes to believing in themselves and playing fluid football. And they are just so scary in that sense. They will never be burdened in the way that England are burdened. They just won't. And it's like, it must be great. I'd love to be Spanish. I've always wished I was Spanish.
burdened with glorious purpose, mate. That's what they are.
It's like, it must be so fun. It's remarkable how they got back on track with such ease, really, from having a relatively tricky time, you know, in their footballing history, because it had been a while since they'd been doing well on the biggest stages. But they're well and truly back. I'm just trying to think of the last time they won the World Cup. It was 2010, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So 2010. By Spanish standards, they wouldn't have expected to go this long because of the team that they had then. Yeah. Without winning this.
Well, like, that team broke a duck as well. So it was like, you know,
totally
it changed
the... Yeah, like that was historic in so many ways, but it felt like they had come... They came of age, but it felt like the footballing nation had come of age. Because, like, you know, Spain don't have a glorious past in the World Cup. Like, it's... by any means. In fact, it's quite surprising when you look at when they've been eliminated throughout the years in the World Cup. But, yeah, they... They just feel special. They feel like they've got something. And winning the Euros was them not even near their best, I don't think. I don't, you know, I think if you, even if you look back at that final performance against England, they'll consider themselves to have been dominant and deserving of the win, but they'll probably thinking, should have won that 3-0.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, they were the perennial underachievers. I don't think it's worth putting that tag anywhere near them now. They are just one of the dominant forces in world football. And look, they've done it in such a fashionable style as well. They're a joy to watch, a joy to behold. And they are number one in this list for very, very good reason. Right, we're going to take a little break then. When we come back afterwards, we're going to take a little look through the dark horses as well. Make sure you stick with us here on Racks FC.
Welcome back to the part where Jack fills in the gaps in our World Cup knowledge with some little glimmers of info that we just need. Jack, are you going to do like dark horses or something like that?
I am indeed going to do dark horses. And look, just before we start, an honourable mention here to Morocco, who are probably like the number one dark horse. But I also don't know if you can have last World Cup semi-finalists as dark horses.
They are dark horses, mate, because everyone's forgotten that. And doesn't realise, like, Morocco are not a flash in the pan here. Like, they are, they're a serious football nation, like, at every level, it seems, at the moment as well.
100%. Like, they're running the block everywhere they go at the moment. And they've been brilliant in qualifying again. Outside of the African Nations Championship, which is a tournament that the European-based players don't actually participate in, they've lost once since January 2024. So this is a side in their pomp, absolutely stormed qualification, incredible performances across the board, some of the most talented players on the earth. But I don't feel comfortable putting them in as dark horses because they got to the semi-finals last time. And I think that they're perfectly reasonable. In fact, I would have had them more in the favourites bracket than in the dark horses bracket. They, you said, who would be my fifth? Would it be the Netherlands? Would it be Germany? Yeah. Fifth for me, Morocco.
Okay, fair.
That's where I have them in terms of my ranking. So I didn't feel comfortable putting them in as dark horses in this one. So I did want to give them a shout out, but I feel like, you know, people should be aware of what Morocco are by this point. They are a footballing powerhouse and they deserve to be respected as such. I have big, big odds on them going far again. Like, this is going to be another impressive tournament, I think, for Morocco. So I was going to pick up a couple of teams who maybe haven't got quite the same limelight. And at three, I've got Ecuador. They have been absolutely brilliant under Sebastian Bekachece. Like, they have like this organizational ability, the structure within this team. And ultimately, they started this qualification campaign with this 3-point deduction that I mentioned earlier on when we were talking about Argentina. And they went on and finished second. They lost twice in 18 matches in CONMEBOL qualification. And both of those defeats came away to Argentina and Brazil. They are so resilient. They are so incredibly well-drilled from a defensive perspective. In Moises Caicedo, they have, by my money, right now, the best defensive midfielder playing on the planet. And he's the man that not only shields that defensive line, but also turns them into a transitional team who gets attacks started, who funnels the ball out to the players who can do damage. It allows someone like Pervis Estupiñán to go flying, marauding down that right-hand side, opening up games. And look, actually, if we talked about England as a potential favourite and being like, look, they're incredibly resilient. They make things happen. They can sit in and defend when they need to. They don't concede goals. They score from a load of set pieces. You could also be talking about Ecuador because they have conceded 4 goals in 15 games under Bekachiche. They have been so impressive, like when they've gone to difficult away grounds, whether they've been at home. The only reason that actually I think they're only down at 3 here is because they draw too many games. They've drawn 9 of 15. And that is probably a slight concern. Are they finding the goals they need to in order to turn those ones into wins? Look, if they win every game and they go to penalties, they'll fancy themselves. If they, you know, if that's how it happens, but it's really, really hard to score against them. And they're very good at turning set piece situations into real big moments. And I think at tournament football, this is something that's going to really, really suit Ecuador. Now, I was quite hot on them before the last World Cup and they really kind of fell through the trapdoor. They really weren't that impressive, but they've only made it once beyond the group stage, which was in 2006. And you'll remember that game because they were beaten by England very narrowly in the last 16. But this is their 5th World Cup of the last 7. And they keep going really well at Copa Americas. At some point, I think that has to translate into a good World Cup run. And with someone like a William Pacho at the back, with Moises Caicedo shielding the defense, with the ability that they have to keep teams at bay, hit on the counter and take advantage of their opportunities, I really do fancy Ecuador to have a bit of a punt at this at this point. So yeah. I'm gonna go and put them into this.
That defense is solid. I mean, they just seem to have a never-ending like list of them. Like, one can't play, suddenly they've got another £50 million one coming through. Like, unbelievable.
Yeah, very, very special team, Ecuador. And they're not that much fun to watch, I'll be honest. They're not like a glorious team that you can't miss a game, but they're very, very hard to beat. Yeah. So, you know, I think they take that trade-off in this regard. At number two, I've gone for Algeria. Unbeaten in 10 games, although they are playing Saudi Arabia as we record this. They're 2-0 up with 10 minutes to go. So I fancy that's going to become 10. And when you kind of come to what they've done, they won 8 of their 10 games in qualifying. Really tough, really competitive group that also included Guinea and Mozambique and Uganda. A lot of names you'll know. Rami Bensbaini having a cracking season at Dortmund. Ryan Aitnori, the old warhorse, Issa Mandi, who I love. Ismail Benacer in the middle of the park. And then these young talents, Ibrahim Mazza, who's really broken out at Leverkusen this season. Hussein Aouar, who is now playing is Saudi Arabia, but still an incredible talent player on his day. And he's Haj Musa, who I've been red hot on at Feyenoord. Striker Mohamed Amoura, who's at Wolfsburg, who scored the crucial goals to beat Uganda on the final day. It's qualifying, as well as Eintracht's brilliant Faris Chaibi and the wild card of Badreddin Bounani, who moved to Stuttgart this summer. There's a nice blend here, Dean, of some very talented youngsters and hard-nosed experience. Now, I think watching them in qualifying, it's the best blend we've seen from an Algeria side in a long time, since you go back to that AFCON, you know, win for them. And I kind of look at it and think they're going to be getting a heap of competitive reps this year. I think they will qualify from their AFCON group. They'll expect to go far in that competition. There is obviously the old mercurial talent of Riyad Mahrez that everyone is going to flock to, but yeah, there's a new star in this attack as well. And Amina Guiri, who's been brilliant for them. He was third highest scorer in AFCON qualifying last year. And the manager, Vladimir Petkovic, he's been in the job for coming up to 2 years. Very few doubts about him or how well he knows the squad. And he seems to have given his creative players the license to dictate take games the way that his predecessor didn't. He's won 19 of his 27 games in charge of Algeria. I think that they're just a team to keep an eye on, both at AFCON and then at the World Cup as well.
Oh, I'm haunted by Algeria, mate. World Cup 2010, England 0, Algeria 0, or the lowest points of Fabio Capello's reign. And I remember Algeria celebrating that moment. One of the most boring England games I've ever seen from an England performance standpoint. I remember a bird landing on the crossbar during the game. That was a highlight, and I'll never forget it. It was down there with England's Roy Hodgson Iceland moment. But Algeria absolutely deserved the acclaim. It was England who let themselves down. Rooney shouting down the camera, nice to hear you booing. Nice to hear booing from your own fans or whatever he shouted down the camera at the time. And they completely rattled us and completely riled us. And at the time, like, it was a huge achievement from Algeria. And now we're at a point, as you say, where expectations are a lot higher than that. And they've really worked hard at bringing through a team that are, easier on the eye for sure, but also expectant to go and, cause problems. And I think they will cause people problems.
Wasn't that the group that was termed easy by the papers in England? Yeah. England, Algeria, was it Slovenia?
USA.
And Yanks.
Yep.
And that was the headline, and England didn't make it through it. So that was a little bit of a punch in the face for the English media.
I can't
media, right?
Enjoy that World Cup very much.
No, I can't imagine you did. That was Clint Dempsey's finest moment outside of the Juventus goal, shall we say. And right, let's go to number one, where the only natural choice here was Norway. Absolutely unbelievable.
Can't wait.
Through qualification. 37 goals across their 8 games in qualification. They thrashed Italy home and away. They have qualified for their first tournament since 1998. Like, a really solid squad, but also the sprinkles of the best players in the world there as well. Erling Haaland up top. Martin Ødegaard has missed the majority of this last stretch. Hasn't bothered them at all. The rock solid foundation of Sander Berg Gallagher and Patrick Berg in the midfield. Antonio Nusa on one wing. Christian Thorsvet on the other. Sola up top with Haaland. Strand Larsen coming off the bench. Christopher Ayer at the back. It's just a wonderful, wonderful team. And they have not been fazed by anyone. And the moment I decided to put them at number one here was this game against Italy, right? They had to not lose 9-0. That was the situation. Yep. As long as they didn't lose 9-0, they were going to the World Cup. What did they do? They went out 1-0 down at halftime. They smacked Italy around in the second half. They dominated them in this unbelievable period of 15 minutes where they just hit the blitz. And at that moment, I was like, oh, right, okay. This is a serious, serious football team. They're not content with going and drawing that game. Not content with going and losing 1-0 and qualifying. They want to put the hammer down. 8 wins out of 8 and just a side that everyone could be very, very excited about watching.
Cannot wait, mate. Cannot wait. I'm so pleased to have him there. I'm so pleased to have Haaland at the tournament. He's going to bring so much colour to the event. I've talked before on the Patreon about this YouTube channel that he's launched. Oh, this is going to be fun. Seeing him going around America, in the build up to America. I think we'll get some good content out of him. I hope so. I hope Norway allow that. But on the pitch, he's going to be unstoppable. They've got such a good attack. Like, it's not just Haaland. They've got players around him that are going to really, really cause problems. And they've got a team ethic and kind of respect for one another that brings a togetherness that is just remarkable. And if you saw the Italy game, like the Norway fans like celebrating it, it was just glorious. And obviously, like, one of the good things about having this 48 team World Cup is it has opened the door for other nations to make it and for fans to be at the event, and that makes it special too, because, you know, there is a level of expectation from the top, say, 8 teams in the tournament, top 10 teams maybe even, that they'll just win. And you don't get limbs from those teams in the opening stages. But teams like Norway are going to go wild for every goal. And Haaland's going to score a fair few of them. They taught Italy a lesson. They really did. I mean, Italians are talking about it as a disaster, and it was a disaster in terms of their performance. But to turn it on Italian soil in a second half performance where you score 4 goals and 3 of the goals come in 15 minutes. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, unbelievable. They are a joy to behold at the moment. Right, with that, we're going to call this a day here on our little World Cup podcast. I hope you've enjoyed a walk through some of the big names and the dark horses that we've looked at. And remember, it's Troy Parrott for the Ballon d'Or. Thank you very much to Mr. Dean Jones.
Cheers, mate.
I've been Jack Collins. This has been Ranks FC. Thank you so much for listening as ever. And we'll see you all very shortly, Rank Squad. Take it easy. Peace.